Indian and foreign medical tourists who travel to this city. The construction of Shomal Hospital kicked off in 2004. In 5,500 square meter plot of land in Amul City. The construction and equipping of the hospital was completed in 2013, and the hospital was officially inaugurated and became operational in 2014. Shomal Hospital has 150 beds and is a first-class general hospital. In fact, it is one of the largest medical centers in the province of Mazandaran and Iran. The facilities of Shomal Hospital are all electronic, and it is one of the best-equipped hospitals of its kind in Iran. With a state-of-the-art medical equipment in accordance with international standards, with the aim of attracting medical tourists. The different wards of this hospital are designed by Germany, and its intensive care unit is fully equipped with a central space monitoring system that patients can easily be informed about their patient's status. This way, the doctors can also remotely monitor the patient's status from their office or home. The hospital includes a clinic with 8 specialized emergency wards, 2 outpatient operating rooms, an inpatient bed, and digital radiology section, and also has wards for obstetrics, gynecology, pediatrics, open heart surgery, gynecological operating rooms, general operating rooms, ICU, NICU, angiography, as well as CCU. The inpatient ward for women, internal medicine, men and children, and the conference hall are all other facilities of this super specialized hospital in northern Iran. The International Patient Unit at Shomal Hospital offers quality services to patients by employing experienced and trained personnel. Admission of international patients in Shomal Hospital is done through this ward and from the time the patients enter the hospital and sometimes even before that. In this section, experts fluent in different languages transfer the patient's contracts and input information given to the hospital by themselves or their representatives to the head of the IPD ward. After the information are reviewed, the necessary steps to refer them to specialized wards are taken in order to perform the necessary treatment process on the patient. All services offered to the international patients are in addition to the general services the hospital usually offer to the patients and are VIP. For this section, very tidy and well-equipped suits are provided so that the patients and their companies face the least issues during their stay. The translators of this section are also constantly present in the ward to provide services to the patient and their companion. In addition, the VIP section of the hospital provides services such as travel planning, face-to-face and online consultation with experts, a translator familiar with the patient's mother tongue, as well as introducing travel tours and visiting the sightseeing of the north to restore the patient's health. Shomal Hospital hosts many health tourists who travel to northern cities of Iran from different countries such as Australia, Persian Gulf countries such as Kuwait, and Iran's neighboring countries such as Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan. Dear listeners, for more information on how to provide services and patient admission in Shomal Hospital, you can call 0098-1144-230-794, 44230752 or 0936372-1310. Or visit the website of this hospital and get more information at http://www.bimarestanshomal.com/en. The website of North Hospital provides the necessary information about the way of hospitalization, medical expenses, address, and other information. In addition to personal visits, you can get all the hospital matters such as coordination, scheduling matters related to your stay, obtaining your visa and ticket through facilitator companies that operate in Iran. Dear listeners, that was the 9th episode of the series Health Tourism. Till next program, goodbye. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Last Days in Vietnam, directed by Rory Kennedy. And joining me in the studio, we have Dave Calhoun, who is a film critic with Time Out magazine. And beside him is Lindsay German, who is the founding member and convener of the British anti-war organization Stop the War Coalition. Now, Last Days in Vietnam examines the chaotic final days of the US's presence in Vietnam and their efforts to help evacuate 135,000 South Vietnamese people as the North Vietnamese forces were closing in on Saigon. Featuring contemporary reflections from those who were there, this documentary also shows the moral dilemmas faced by US soldiers and diplomats during the unsanctioned evacuation.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam. We have adopted a plan for the complete withdrawal of all U.S. combat ground forces. We are finally bringing American men home.
The American troops were gone, and as a result, the house of cards began to collapse.
We were dealing with an ambassador who was just convinced that somehow there wouldn't have to be an evacuation, and therefore there wouldn't have to be a concern about evacuating South Vietnamese.
These people were dead men walking. Sometimes there's an issue not of legal and illegal, but right or wrong. I borrowed a truck, and I drove them to the airbase. And I had told them, when you hear three thumps, that means hold the baby's mouths, don't breathe, don't talk, don't make any noise. I was going to get them out.
Saigon has begun.
That morning, there must have been at least 10,000 people ringing the embassy.
There was a sea of people wanting to get out. They looked up at the helicopters leaving, and I could see their eyes, desperate eyes.
There are no words to describe what a ship looks like. It holds 200 and it's got 2,000 of them.
We have no more helicopters. That's it.
As it took off, I could see the group right where we had left them. It was just so serious and deep a betrayal. Who goes? And who gets left behind?
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, the U.S. Fought in the Vietnam War for nearly 20 years, from 1955 to 1975. And, of course, their alleged role was to stop the spread of communism. But, of course, in this documentary, it doesn't really talk about this aspect of the war. More so, it focuses on the last days of U.S. troops in Vietnam, as the title of the documentary suggests. And, Dave, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, how would you summarize what Last Days in Vietnam is about, and what was your take on it?
Yeah, as you say, it's a particularly human story. It looks at the, as the title says, the final days of American involvement in 1975 in South Vietnam, and particularly in Saigon. After the withdrawal of troops in 1973, there were still between 5,000 and 7,000 U.S. military personnel or advisors still in South Vietnam, many of them in Saigon. And what the film does is, using archive footage and new interviews, it builds up a portrait of what happened in April 1975 as those U.S. personnel had to scramble to leave the city and the country, and also what they decided to do or not to do to help those people, South Vietnamese and those living in Saigon, who they knew and who they'd been working with, many of them were in relationships with, or who they considered, some of them considered family.
They were very well integrated into the country.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's moral dilemmas that come up through that. I found it a pretty gripping film, actually. And it's a micro portrait of this particular chapter in the history of the Vietnam War. I mean, this final chapter is very well put together, and I found it pretty illuminating. Mm.
And Lindsay, if I could turn to you now, would you agree with what Dave said? What was your take on this documentary?
Well, I agree with Dave. I thought it was a very good film, and it got across this sort of moral dilemma very, very well. I think my big criticism of it is not about the film itself, and maybe this shouldn't be a criticism of the film, but that the context of what's going on isn't really developed in the way that it should be. So you see sort of pictures of maps that the North Vietnamese are coming and are surrounding Saigon and are just a few hours away and all this kind of thing, without actually sort of looking at the backstory of what happened. So I think it was it's a very well-made film. It's a very human story, because it's about what happens to the people, which can happen in any war where you're on the losing side, and what then happens, and it can be very, very hard for people in that circumstance. And you can understand why both the Americans wanted to get their friends and family out, and also why some of the South Vietnamese thought that if the North Vietnamese came, they wouldn't have much of a future. But I think that lack of context also does weaken the film's message, I suppose, or gives you one side of the message.
And I want to tear apart, actually, the more on the political context of the film in the next part of the discussion. But just for now, we're going to take a brief break.
Big Chinook showed up. There's no way he can land on Kirk without impacting the ship. He would have killed everybody on the helicopter plus my crew.
It was way too big to land. We thought that the helicopter would just fly away. But as the ship was moving forward, probably 4, 5, 6 knots, something like that, the pilot communicated that he was running low on fuel.
He opened up the port side of the helicopter and he hovered across the stern to Kirk. Then all of a sudden, here comes a human.
One by one, we jump out. I jumped out, my brother jumped out. My mom was holding my sister. Obviously very scared. And she just, just trustingly, just with one hand, with her right hand, holding on with her left to brace herself, just dropped my baby sister.
One fella standing there, and he said he looked up and he saw this big bundle of stuff come flying out, and it was a baby. It was the one-year-old baby. And then the mother jumped out and he caught her too.
There are some really great evacuation stories in this film. And just before we went to that clip, as you were saying, this, from a cinematic perspective, this documentary is a great documentary. And Lindsay, if I could ask you, what evacuation story stood out the most to you?
Well, I like the whole way that they did it. The thing that perhaps I remember most is this thing where they say that there was this signal, which would, when they knew they had to evacuate, which would come on the radio, and I forget what the phrase was, but then they said they would play Bing Crosby's White Christmas, which I thought was perhaps one of the most bizarre things in terms of what was going on in Vietnam, the whole war and everything. So I suppose that really stood out. But lots and lots of people trying to get there, the people, and even with that message was the message about White Christmas was you have to come with your family to the embassy with only one suitcase, which I guess is a pretty, I mean, all right, it's, you're getting out, but you're getting out with not very much stuff. So I thought they were very moving. And the one about the man who went and got his family, the Vietnamese pilot who went and got his family in his helicopter and just took the helicopter, went and got his family and got them out. So they were very moving stories, I thought, and they were, you know, obviously people were in a very desperate situation.
Indeed, and according to this documentary, the events described in it includes the stories of some 77,000 South Vietnamese people. And Dave, if I could ask you the same question, what story stood out the most for you?
I mean, I agree. I mean, there's very, very many there. And I agree also, actually, yeah, some of those code slogans and things they hear on the radio are, you know, particularly, they do stick in the mind. To be honest, actually, I mean, as well as all the stories of people that do leave, I mean, some of the stories that stick in my mind are the hints of the people that were left behind. I mean, towards the very end of the film, we see some of those very famous images of people clambering over the walls of the US embassy after the last 11 people are helicoptered away. I mean, one of the many powerful evacuation stories is of the last of the 11 US soldiers are clambering into the helicopter. But there's one person who recalls, a South Vietnamese man who had been a soldier, who recalls how, as soon as he realized, you know, Saigon had fallen, it was over, North Vietnamese were all over the city, and he took off his uniform, got rid of his badge, burnt his military identification card, and just to so he could make it clear that he was just a civilian once again. I think that one story, for me, just sort of powerfully evokes, you know, the idea of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people left behind who would have had to very, very quickly readjust to a different way of life, you know, potentially with the threat of being, you know, of recrimination if they had, you know, if it was proved that they had been collaborating with the Americans or had been in the South Vietnamese army.
And now all these stories are very well, but I just want to challenge sort of this heroic narrative, of course, that many mainstream documentaries about the Vietnam War puts across, especially particularly in this documentary, Lindsay. What do you think of this heroic narrative? I mean, it's not in a vacuum. Did the US soldiers have any business being in Vietnam anyway?
Well, I would argue they didn't, and I think most people now, in terms of the, you know, the 40 years or so since the final fall of Saigon, would argue the same, that it was not a just war, it was an absolutely brutal war, which went on. The French, first of all, fought it because it was their former colony, then the United States came in. And if you look at what they did, the use of chemical weapons in the form of Agent Orange, which caused massive environmental and human damage, it's estimated that 2 million Vietnamese died, 58,000 US soldiers died. And the US soldiers, I mean, the thing that's very missing from this, and probably accurately it's missing because by that time the regular soldiers had gone, but the soldiers themselves killed many of their officers. It was the biggest sort of mutiny or mutinous atmosphere that the Americans ever had to deal with in wartime. And of course, many, many soldiers demonstrated when they were back in the States, were involved in the anti-war movement. It was a mass movement. And none of that, of course, comes across. But there was a great sense that this was an injustice, that by the mid-60s, a great sense it was an injustice. And that was reflected not just in the US, in Germany there were huge demos, in Britain, in all of the Western countries, people were very, very much against it.
That was a very powerful point. And Dave, I'd like to pick up on your thoughts on that also in the next part.
When President Ford went before the Congress, he had two major concerns. The first was to save as many people as we could. He cared for the human beings involved, but they were not just pawns that once they had lost their military power were abandoned. The second was the honor of America, that we would not be seen at the final agony of South Vietnam as having stabbed it in the back.
Congress wouldn't pass it. They said no more, you know, no more troops, no more money, no more aid to the Vietnamese. Well, I had to go into President Ford's office to tell him.
Now, Dave, I just wanted to pick up on a point that Lindsay made earlier on before we went to the clip. Would you have liked to have seen more political context to this documentary, perhaps to expose more of the crimes in the area?
I think it's very good on the micro. It's very good on those final days, those final weeks in Saigon. It's not especially good on the wider context of the war, which, as you said at the very beginning, has spanned two decades. It's not particularly great on the immediate political context, which is hinted at by that clip either. I mean, it reduces the background politics to a fairly simple Ford was willing to provide more aid to the South Vietnamese. Congress said no. It does. You mentioned heroism before. I mean, it does point the finger of heroism towards Gerald Ford as well there. Mm-hmm. And obviously Kissinger was in his government at the time, so obviously has, you know, a reason to be pushing that narrative as well. But but at the same time, the film doesn't set out to offer that context. I think I'd have been a bit more dismayed if it offered the context in a more simplistic way, or in a more narrow-minded or biased way. And I think it prefers to avoid it, prefers just to put you into the melee of those final days, and it does that well.
Mm-hmm. And Lindsay, following on from that clip, they showed Henry Kissinger, who was in this documentary, and some would accuse him of being a war criminal. How do you think he was portrayed in this documentary?
Well, I think he's portrayed very favourably in the documentary, and of course when he says in that clip, you know, we were concerned about human life. I mean, it's a slightly grotesque way to talk about it when you think of how many people had died by the time that he was describing this final evacuation. So I think it's kinder to Kissinger than probably history is or will be to him. I think he played a bad role in all of this. And of course, they kept escalating this war. This is what people forget. It's only in these last years that they de-escalated, and even in 75 they're talking about more money going to prop up what was a puppet government in South Vietnam. You know, I think it's quite unsatisfactory at that level, but perhaps not surprising as well. Once you've got Henry Kissinger to interview, which is quite a coup, then you're not going to ask him any challenging questions probably. Mm-hmm.
And would you agree with that, Dave?
I would. I mean, it would have been interesting to know. I mean, going back to that particular clip there, and again, the film doesn't really set out to offer this context, but it would have been interesting to know more about the reason, why Congress was so opposed to offering more aid at that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, presumably partly because the Vietnam War for the American people had become a massive millstone around the American people's neck, and it was just something that they really wished to put behind them, you know, for many, many valid reasons. But the film doesn't explore that. It leaves those questions begging if you don't bring a lot of knowledge to the film.
Actually, Lindsay, I think that relates to you. I mean, as someone who was inspired into political activism by the Vietnam War, what was the anti-war movement like at that time, and do you think this was affecting Congress's decision?
Well, no. Funnily enough, by the time this was happening, the anti-war movement was much weaker than it had been in the late 60s and early 70s, partly because most of the troops had gone. People could see that it was coming to an end. But there was very, very big sentiment against the war, and there was and also the point that Dave makes is right, I think, about the politically people were, it was an absolute millstone around their necks. But also by the mid-70s, the world economy had turned towards very serious recession after decades of boom. Mm-hmm. So, of course, the Americans were also thinking that we can't really afford this. And it's usually accepted that the Vietnam War was a big driver of inflation in the 60s and early 70s, which led to some of this economic crisis. So I think they just thought, you know, let's get out of here. We've, as the Americans quite often do, we've seen this before and since. Mm-hmm. And
it was a very interesting discussion so far, but we'll just have to pause for now.
Thought of my friends who were killed in action, and I thought, well, is this what we fought for? Is this what the Americans came for? And I didn't have the answer.
I have wrestled with this ever since I realized that I had become the quintessential American in Vietnam. I had all these causes, all these big things I was doing. I was trying to get the truth back to Washington. I was talking to agents, trying to persuade the ambassador. And I forgot that what was at stake were human lives.
For years after that, I hear that sound in my head, that sound like ch-ch-ch-ch. In the middle of the night, I just jump up. I thought the helicopter come pick me up. I call it Dream in the Wind.
That's absolutely devastating, Will. Now, Dave, one of the criticisms you can make of this documentary is that the number of people who have died, the casualties from the war, is missing. I mean, it's not until 1995 did Vietnam release its official estimate of the death toll, as many as 2 million civilians on both sides and some 1.1 million North Vietnamese and Viet Cong fighters, whereas the U.S. military actually say that between 200,000 and 250,000 South Vietnamese soldiers died, so it's a fraction compared to Vietnamese statistics. Do you think this is a weakness of the documentary also? Would you have liked to have seen this more?
I think the film struggles slightly actually to know how to end and how to conclude, because it doesn't do that. It doesn't wrap up with a summary of, because these events are the final events of the Vietnam War. It could very naturally then have a conclusion which wraps up the entire history of a two decade conflict, but it doesn't do that. And I think I pretty welcome the fact it doesn't, because it would turn it into something else. I mean, it does deal with high level politics at some points. You know, it deals with decisions that have to be made by U.S. generals and the U.S. ambassador in Saigon. But it does try to bring it back to the experience of more ground level, you know, people on both sides, mm-hmm. For Americans and South Vietnamese, wherever it can. I think if it just gave us a load of figures and statistics at the end, it would be a little bit unfaithful to the film it has been before, really. So I think it tries to end on, as we see there, on a more human, a more sorrowful note. Mm. And I think it tries to give a sense of, you know, the futility of war generally on the human level. I'm not sure it does that entirely powerfully. I'm not sure it does that as powerfully as it does, as it achieves other things throughout the film. But I think I welcome it trying to end on that note.
Yeah. Which is fair enough, I suppose. And Lindsay, I mean, the US lost some at least 58,000 troops. Mm. And I've read in my research that this is still a controversial issue as to the US narrative is that they didn't win the war, they didn't lose the war. Why is this such a still controversial issue?
I think it's a very big question still in America. I mean, obviously, the surviving veterans and the surviving anti-war protesters come to that are now older, you know, they're now quite old, they're people who are sort of pensioner age and so on. It's still a very contested thing. There's still a very contested thing. Was it justified? There's still many, many veterans who are disabled and who are mentally and physically ill as a result of the war. And of course, America doesn't like losing wars. I mean, this is Trump's election. You know, he says we don't mind going to war, but we want to be able to win those wars. And of course, Vietnam showed them they couldn't win the war despite this huge superior air power and military might in general, despite targeting quite deliberately civilians, which they did, who they claimed were sort of hiding the Viet Cong and the people who were fighting. Despite all this, they lost, and they lost because of what the Vietnamese people themselves did. They lost because their own soldiers didn't have the faith in it that perhaps they might have done in previous wars. And they lost because the people at home said, look, we don't want this either. So I think it's still a very big issue in American politics. And of course, it's contemporary in the sense that there was what was called the Vietnam Syndrome, which did stop these interventions for the best part of 20 years. Mm-hmm. And now we're back with a vengeance with all of those.
Well, it's really great how to see how it relates to today as well. And I'm afraid we'll have to leave the discussion here. I wish we could talk longer. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks to my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
May 7th, 2021. Today, unity is the biggest weapon for the Palestinians. The enemies of Palestinian unity are the Zionist regime, the US, and some other political powers. But if unity is not shattered from inside the Palestinian society itself, the extrinsic enemies will not be able to do anything. The pivot of this unity should be national jihad and lack of trust in the enemies. The main enemies of the Palestinians, the US, England, and vicious Zionists, should not be used as a source of support for Palestinian politics. All Palestinians, including the Palestinians in Gaza, in Quds, in the West Bank, in 1948 lands, and even the ones living in refugee camps, form a single unit, and they should adopt the strategy of coalitions. Every part should defend another part, and when under pressure, they should utilize the tools at their disposal. Today, hope of achieving victory is stronger than ever. Today, the balance of power has swung in favor of the Palestinians. The Zionist enemy has become weaker year after year, while its army, which used to describe itself as the army which will never be defeated, has turned into an army which will never taste victory. After its debacle in the 33-day war in Lebanon and its experiences in 22-day and 8-day wars. As for its political condition, it has been forced to hold 4 elections in the space of 2 years. In terms of security as well, it continuously tastes defeat. Moreover, the increasing desire among Jews to immigrate from that land has become a source of embarrassment for that overconfident regime. Its serious endeavor to normalize relations with a few Arab countries with the assistance of the US is another sign of the decline of that regime. Of course, this will not help that regime in any way either. Tens of years ago, it established relations with Egypt, but since then it has become much weaker and much more vulnerable. Therefore, will the normalization of relations with a few weak and small countries be able to help that regime? Of course, those countries will not benefit from the relations either, as the Zionist regime will transgress against their properties and their land, and it will promote corruption and insecurity in their countries. Of course, these truths should not make others forget about their heavy duty.
Allah,
Of Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell has posed a series of questions to EU legislators in the light of the Afghanistan catastrophe. He asked, what does it mean for our relations with the US? And then he went on.
What does it mean for the development of European strategic autonomy, for our security and for our defense policy?
During the two-hour European Parliament debate, at least a dozen lawmakers told Borrell the last thing the EU needs is more military spending.
The lessons to be learned. We have to end universal interventionism that has only led to disasters in Syria, Iraq and Afghanistan.
Apparently, the West demonstrated enormous arrogance in Afghanistan.
In overshooting self-confidence, instead of helping nation-building, we try to impose nation building.
The US-led invasion of Afghanistan resulted in a countless number of civilian deaths and also life-changing injuries. We have visited a center for asylum seekers in Brussels. As they wait for help, people here feel let down by EU and Belgian authorities.
They don't care about women, they don't care about children. Why they do like this? What's the difference between Afghanistan and Belgium?
The plight of Afghan refugees was also talked about at length during the European Parliament debate.
The selfishness of many European authorities and political parties that showed no solidarity towards those refugees that left the country.
The reason given for going into the country to defeat terrorism was rubbished.
You were killing innocent people, women and children. You were creating terrorists, fighting migration. You were destroying the place. You were creating migrants.
The European Economic and Social Committee has published a statement pleading with EU leaders to cooperate in a meaningful way with key countries surrounding Afghanistan, including Iran, Pakistan, China, India, and Russia, in order to achieve the stabilization of Central Asia. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Turkish foreign minister said that Turkey is working with the United Nations to resettle Syrian refugees in Syria. Mevlut Cavusoglu added that the international community has started to understand the gravity of the situation. Cavusoglu's comments came days after a visit by UNHCR chief Filippo Grandi, who met both the foreign minister and the Turkish president. Cavusoglu underlined the importance not to force the refugees to return, but encourage them through providing them housing, education, health and employment resources.
We are now receiving better support from the international community for the safe return and repatriation of refugees. We are working to repatriate refugees, especially in Syria, especially with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees.
The AK ruling party is facing criticism from the people and opposition parties for the way it is handling the refugee crisis. Many are blaming the presence of the refugees for the rise in prices and bad economic situation. Turkish people have become very sensitive towards this issue, with some even refusing to deal with foreigners. House owners are now refusing to rent their houses to foreigners which has created a state of racism in the country that many are calling on the government to find a solution to.
This topic particularly is considered very sensitive to Turkey, and it also concerns other countries in the region that are also hosting refugees, such as Jordan, Lebanon, and Iraq. Turkey is pushing towards this solution due to several reasons. The main one is the upcoming election and the opposition using the refugee card against the ruling party. Another reason is the people's pressure, who are blaming the presence of Syrian refugees for the deteriorating economic situation in the country. Therefore, the current Turkish government is trying to fix this issue before 2023 elections.
UNHCR says Syria is still considered too dangerous to send refugees back. UNHCR spokesperson says that only a political solution would allow people to return, assuring that refugees should have the right to voluntarily return in safe and dignified conditions. However, several countries, including Turkey, are pressuring the Syrian refugees to return to their home country, claiming it is safe now for their return. Turkey has long been hosting migrants and refugees from different countries in the region. However, with the deteriorating economic situation in the country, people are now calling on their government to stop receiving more refugees and send the already existing ones home. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
It was supposed to be seamless trading post-Brexit, but it doesn't seem to be working, and the developments of the past few days are a testament. The Northern Ireland Protocol, agreed upon by the UK and EU to avoid trade problems, has become a problem itself. Now the UK is threatening to unilaterally suspend it.
Article 16 says that this article can be triggered unilaterally by either side if there's some aspect of the treaty which is causing unforeseen social, economic or environmental problems. But there's nothing about the way that the Northern Ireland Protocol is operating now, which is unforeseen. It has led de facto to a border between the six counties of the north of Ireland and Britain.
The warning came from Brexit Minister Lord Frost, only days after the leader of Northern Ireland's pro-UK ruling party warned of a new era of violence and instability if the protocol collapsed.
That our political institutions will not survive a failure.
The UK has been pushing for a renegotiation of the protocol, despite Prime Minister Boris Johnson promising during Brexit negotiations that it wouldn't impact the flow of goods to and from Northern Ireland.
There will not be checks on goods going from Northern Ireland to Great Britain, because we're the government of the United Kingdom and we will not institute.
A promise Boris Johnson hasn't been able to keep. Instead, he's announced grace periods since January last year to delay the agreement's full implementation. Meanwhile, the European Union, who threatened legal action but are yet to take it, say the UK made its bed and has to lie in it.
They want to have their cake and eat it. They want both to be able to satisfy their own workers at home and have a smash the red wall, claim to be in favour of Brexit, claim to be in favour of British workers, and at the same time be inside the European club.
The agreement was forged to prevent a hard border between Northern Ireland and EU member Republic of Ireland, and to protect the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. The two sides agreed that goods entering Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK had to be checked according to EU rules. That didn't sit well with the pro-UK unionists.
The Northern Ireland Protocol is underpinned by international law. Any violation of it will dent international trust in the government here. And the whole escalating row over the protocol is yet another episode in the ongoing Brexit saga, rekindling questions about whether or not the UK's divorce from the single market was a good idea after all. Saeed Purisa, London.
It has been known for a long time that the United States is guilty of espionage against its closest ally, the European Union. The matter has just been debated in the European Parliament. It is time the 27-nation bloc had its own intelligence agency to respond, lawmakers suggest.
Le 30 mai dernier.
Just look at the 30th of May. Media investigations showed that Denmark and the NSA cooperated in spying on German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French, Norwegian, Swedish, German journalists.
The fact that EU member Denmark has been working with the US to spy on other EU nations is surely a scandal. Also, Israel has been condemned in the European Parliament for selling its Pegasus military spyware to Saudi Arabia so that Riyadh can hack into the phones of EU politicians, government advisers, lawyers, journalists and academics.
How do you think the world should approach the Israeli government in regards to its involvement? What should be the precedence so that we deter such cases in the future?
The answer, critics argue, is that EU authorities will do nothing because they are afraid of upsetting Washington, Riyadh and Tel Aviv. Some claim motives for this activity given by the US do not add up.
I think America uses the terrorism concept a lot to promote its surveillance agenda. And that's a concern because I think the actual figures of persons who are afflicted by terrorism is actually quite small.
Turning a blind eye to the problem is an insult to citizens, one expert told the European Parliament debate.
All intelligence activity impinges on human rights. It just does. So it impacts on your right to enjoyment, maybe freedom of movement, it might be right to communication and all the rest of it. So the key point there is on the legality.
Another expert who was invited to the debate told legislators that we are only seeing the tip of the iceberg when it comes to foreign nations spying on the EU. Margarita Carrillo from the University of Canada warned that this problem is never going to go away, and therefore EU authorities need to come up with a firm plan in order to preserve the bloc's much talked about values. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip demonstrated in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to drum up support for thousands of Palestinian prisoners languishing inside Israeli prisons and the escapees from the Gilboa Maximum Security Prison. They called for the immediate release of all Palestinian prisoners, especially women and children. During a press conference in front of the Red Cross office, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas conditioned any future prisoner exchange with the regime on the release of the Gilboa escapees.
Our prisoners, including the six escapees, will be freed soon, despite all Zionist leaders' attempts to keep them behind bars. God willing, the six inmates will be on the top of the list of any prisoner swap deal. Those serving multiple life sentences and all female prisoners, as well as sick prisoners, will be freed in any future prisoner swap deal.
The Israeli prison service keeps Palestinian inmates under deplorable conditions, lacking proper hygienic standards. Palestinian prisoners have also been subjected to systematic torture, harassment, and repression. Prisoners' advocacy groups accused the Israeli regime of increasing the ill-treatment of Palestinian prisoners following last week's historic escape of the six prisoners.
Following the heroic escape from the Gilboa prison, the Israeli prison service began fierce oppressive campaigns against all Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails. It has transferred scores of prisoners to other jails and isolated dozens of them. The campaigns by the Israeli prison service include strip searching and torturing the prisoners. Some prisoners have sustained serious injuries.
A former prisoner who was released during the 2011 prisoner swap deal with the Israeli regime told Press TV, Israel violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the 4th Geneva Convention.
Sick prisoners with chronic diseases are in critical condition due to medical negligence by the Israeli regime. Some 230 prisoners have lost their lives inside Israeli jails since 1967 because of medical negligence. Israel is an illegitimate and inhumane regime, and its prison service continues to violate all international laws and norms, mainly in the 4th Geneva Convention regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Experts say that the protection Israel enjoys from Western countries, mainly the United States, gives it the green light to further violate the rights of Palestinians. People here consider Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails as political prisoners and freedom fighters. Securing the release is a highly emotive issue for all Palestinians. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
The International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors opens a weekly session just the day after IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi's trip to Tehran. Grossi had raised concerns about IAEA access to monitoring equipment in Iran and safeguards-related questions about the country's past nuclear activities. Rafael Grossi said no one could expect him to resolve the outstanding safeguards-related issues with Iran within a 10-hour visit to the country. The most urgent matter, however, the imminent loss of IAEA data, had been adequately addressed. The IAEA's surveillance cameras will now continue to record data that will be kept in Iran under joint seals. But for how long? Apparently, as long as it takes for talks to revive the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA to bear fruit.
You may have seen that this issue of the length has not been addressed. And the fact is that we, having discussed this, we agreed that it is better and more practical to go about it as developments evolve. It is a breach to give us some monitoring and verification capacity until there is something hopefully better.
Grossi said he would soon travel back to Iran to have a clear conversation with the new Iranian government, which in his words has very firm ideas with regards to nuclear activities. Iran's ambassador to the IAEA says all of the country's nuclear activities, including enrichment at the 20 and 60% levels and the production of uranium metal, are within Iran's rights under the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and in line with the country's safeguards commitments. Kazem Gharibabadi says since the US's unilateral sanctions against Iran are still in place and the other sides have not lived up to their commitments under the nuclear deal to remove them, nobody can demand that Iran stop these activities. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Iran's fully indigenous Sahan frigate and Macron floating base are back in the Persian Gulf after more than 4 months of sailing that took them as far as the northern end of the Atlantic Ocean, over a distance of 44,000 kilometers. The naval crew were warmly welcomed by senior military officials, who feel proud that Iran's navy is now capable of sailing in the high sea for extended periods.
We passed through three oceans, the Indian Ocean, the South Atlantic, and North Atlantic Ocean. On the way, we passed through rough seas and finally arrived in Russia's St. Petersburg port. We then sailed all the way back home. All the mission took us some 4.5 months. This is the farthest point we have ever sailed to.
Sahan Frigate is a radar evading vessel that's equipped with torpedo launchers and electronic warfare technologies. And Macron Floating Base is a support vessel that's fitted with a large helicopter pad. Sahan and Macron departed from the Persian Gulf in early May. The two ships passed by Cape of Good Hope, rounded Africa, and sailed through the North Atlantic Ocean to reach Russia, all without docking for refueling on the way.
Throughout our journey, we did not stop to refuel or recharge our medical or food supplies. We went straight to our destination. We had our support vessel Macron along with Sahan that refueled it along the way. It sends a strong message to our enemies, especially the U.S., which tried to play down our naval might.
Iran's defense sector has been under 4 decades of U.S.-led arms embargoes. Iranian officials say they have viewed the sanctions as an opportunity to gain self-sufficiency in the industry. Iran now claims that it has indigenized more than 80% of its arsenal, from drones and helicopters to warships and submarines.
The Iranian Navy is back from the longest voyage in its history. To Iran, sailing through the Atlantic Ocean was a game-changer for two reasons. First, it shows that the country can rely on its domestically built equipment for tough naval missions amid U.S. arms embargoes. And most importantly, it adds Iran to the short list of countries with a blue-water navy. Yusuf Jalali from the Persian Gulf.
Abu Ubaida, spokesman for the Izzeddin al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas, pledged in a speech to release the prisoners who were rearrested after escaping from an Israeli jail on Monday. He also stressed that the rearrest of the prisoners does not hide the extent of shame Israel is going through, as Palestinian inmates have shaken their security system reputation.
No prisoner swap deal will be made without the release of our heroic prisoners who were rearrested by the occupation forces. We promise our inmates that they will be liberated soon within the no swap deal. Our inmates have exposed the fragility of the security of the enemy.
Immediately after Abu Ubaida's speech, Palestinian resistance fired rockets toward the occupied lands, to show that they are ready to face the Israeli regime and defend Palestinians. In response, the Israeli airplane launched an airstrike on the Gaza Strip.
The Palestinian resistance has achieved many goals. First, it succeeded in forcing the Israeli regime out of Gaza. Second, it demolished the Zionist thought of having this land for themselves. Israeli violations and attacks against Palestinians will never terrify us.
In conjunction with this, the resistance factions held a national conference, stressing the importance of the resistance.
The clashes with this Israeli regime will persist. The regime can never feel secure as long as it steals our rights and kills our people. We will never leave our prisoners alone, and the resistance will set them free.
On Saturday evening, the rearrested prisoners appeared at the Israeli court in the city of Nazareth to extend their detention while being deprived of having a lawyer. Palestinians here stress on supporting the Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails and considering them the symbol of the Palestinian issue. Palestinian factions believe that the resistance is the only way to get their rights back. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah said on Monday that the first Iranian fuel shipment has reached the Banias port in Syria and will be transported by land to Lebanon this week.
The transport of fuel from Syria to the Bekaa begins Thursday, and it will be stored in specific tanks, and a second ship will arrive in Banias within a few days. The third ship, which I have mentioned before, has been prepared. All managerial prerequisites have been accomplished, so the vessel will be ready to sail. We're also preparing the logistics for the fourth shipment. About a month later, we'll see if we need a fifth or sixth ship. I need to clarify that we don't seek any gains on this fuel. We'll be for all Lebanese and everyone who lives in Lebanon.
In his Talvi speech, Sayyid Nasrallah noted that Hezbollah will offer a one-month fuel donation to state-run hospitals, nursing homes, orphanages, disability centers, state-run water institutions, municipalities that have water wells, the civil defense, and the Lebanese Red Cross. Experts believe the speech highlights a roadmap Hezbollah has put forth to alleviate the fuel crisis the Lebanese people are dealing with, in light of the government's inactivity, and at the same time, challenges pressures imposed by the West against the nation.
Hezbollah's decision to bring in fuel and even warn the enemies that it will be considered Lebanese assets and that any strike on the ships will lead to retaliation was a very influential issue. It dealt a blow to the U.S. sanctions, whether against Iran, Syria, or Lebanon. The fact that the ship has reached its destination safely and has unloaded its cargo is in itself a victory.
The Hezbollah chief stressed that the resistance's deterrence power kept the ship safe. He said once the shipment reaches its destination, the fuel will be distributed carefully to prevent any potential profit seekers from taking advantage.
Lebanon has been sleeping in the dark for many nights. Sayyid Nasrallah has stressed that Hezbollah's initiative to bring in fuel to Lebanon from Iran will not only bring electricity, but will also break the current U.S. sanctions against the country. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight. Published in 2015, the final report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of